This is Audible.
Blue Heron Audio presents Extinction Shadow, Extinction Cycle, Dark Age, Book 1, by Nicholas Sansbury Smith and Anthony J. Melchiori. Read by R.C. Bray. Introduction to the Extinction Cycle and Historical Recap. From Extinction Cycle creator, Nicholas Sansbury Smith. Dear listener, for those of you that are new to the Extinction Cycle storyline, you're about to embark on a completely new saga based on the original award-winning, Amazon top-rated, and half-a-million-copy best-selling seven-book series. Critics have called the Extinction Cycle World War Z and The Walking Dead meets the Hot Zone. Publishers Weekly added, Smith has realized that the way to rekindle interest in zombie apocalypse fiction is to make it louder, longer, and bloodier. Smith intensifies the disaster efficiently as the pages flip by, and readers who enjoy juicy blood and guts action will find a lot of it here. Extinction Cycle Dark Age is the continuation of the original story, taking place 8 years after the events of Book 7, Extinction War. Before you dive in, please listen to this for a brief history of the series and what to expect for new and old listeners. In creating the Extinction Cycle, my goal was to use authentic military action and real science to take the zombie and post-apocalyptic genres in an exciting new direction. Forget everything you know about zombies. In this story, they aren't created by black magic or other supernatural means. The infected are a result of a military bioweapon called VX-99, first used in Vietnam in a government program to design a super soldier. Chemicals from VX-99 activate proteins encoded by dormant genes that separate humans from wild animals, a real process known as epigenetic changes. In other words, these weapons turned men into monsters. Known as variants, these creatures become the perfect predator as they evolve from epigenetic changes. The result in the extinction cycle is catastrophic, and the infection spreads worldwide. Governments and militaries fall, and civilization is destroyed in a matter of months. Scrambling to find a cure and defeat the monsters, humanity is brought to the brink of extinction. By the end of Book 7, the human race hangs on by a thread. Now, 8 years later, the survivors in the United States, now called the Allied States, have migrated and settled into approximately 100 outposts. Most of these walled-off cities are in the Midwest and the East Coast, with the West Coast largely abandoned due to the severity of the damage from the war. President Jan Ringgold and her administration have worked tirelessly to rebuild, bringing back basic infrastructure, the agricultural industry, manufacturing, and the energy grid. A few other key players helped humanity survive the Great War of Extinction and continued to drive progress in the aftermath. Team Ghost, an Army Delta Force team, played a vital role in winning the war and pushing back the variant scourge. They are still in action under the leadership of Master Sergeant Joe Fitz Fitzpatrick. For 8 years, they have run missions into enemy territory to hunt variants and rescue human prisoners. Other heroes from the era include Captain Reed Beckham and Dr. Kate Lovato. They are now married and live in Outpost Portland, Maine, with their son Javier Riley, Master Sergeant Parker Horn, and his daughters. With President Jan Ringgold's term coming to an end, a new election looms on the horizon. An election candidate and current Vice President Dan Lemke should win easily due to the tremendous progress their administration has made. The country is surviving, and aside from random variant and raider attacks, the outposts are safe. The surviving variants and the human collaborators remain in the shadows, starving and dying off. At least, that's what the military thinks. An extinction cycle dark age. They are about to find out how wrong they are. Strap in. You're about to re-enter the world of variants and the heroes that stand in their way and the next chapter of the extinction cycle. Welcome back to all of the old listeners. I'm so glad you encouraged me to return to this storyline. I promise you're in for a ride with some of your favorite characters and new twists. To new listeners, we invite you to embark on this post-apocalyptic adventure and hope you enjoy the science, action, and characters in this expanding universe. Thank you to all for listening. Please feel free to reach out to me or Tony if you have questions or comments. You can easily find us online. Best wishes. Nicholas Sansbury Smith, New York Times best-selling author of Helldivers and the Extinction Cycle. And Anthony J. Melchiori, best-selling author of The Tide. The boundaries which divide life from death are at best shadowy and vague. Who shall say where the one ends and where the other begins? Edgar Allan Poe. 1. The crackle of a bonfire was a familiar sound at Outpost Turkey River, and would be even more common now that autumn had set in. The smoke was supposed to keep bugs away, but it didn't always work. Retired Master Sergeant Cedric Long swatted a mosquito away from the cavity where his left eye had once been, smearing the damn insect across his cheek. It was already swollen with blood. The little vampires reminded him of the monsters beyond the walls, the same type that took his eye during the war. Variants. The result of a chemical weapon gone wrong. Former humans that had turned into the perfect predators would do far worse than a swarm of bloodthirsty mosquitoes if they got into the outpost. But that wasn't going to happen. Not on this eve, and not on any other day that Cedric held watch. Outpost Turkey River was one of the most secure townships in what was now called the Allied States because of the men that served here before Cedric arrived, and it was even stronger now that he was here. That's what Commander Justin Bell had told him, and Commander Bell was no liar. Now in his late 30s, Bell was just a young man during the Great War of Extinction that ended 8 years ago. But he was no stranger to monsters that lurked deep in what had once been the United States of America. The commander had fought and bled to keep this outpost secure and safe. Cedric squinted into the darkness. There hadn't been an attack for over 3 months. He knew the variants still dwelled in the shadows, but it was mostly humans they had to worry about now. Bandits, raiders, collaborators, whatever people wanted to call them. They would always rather take something that didn't belong to them instead of working to get it themselves, and the most evil among them worked with the variants. Many outposts weren't lucky like Turkey River, with a plentiful supply of fresh food and clear water provided by the fertile land. Supplies were abundant here, which made them a target, not to mention a political hotspot. President Jan Ringgold had stopped by a week earlier with Vice President Dan Lemke. Now that their 2 terms were almost up, Lemke was running to succeed her. Retired General Mark Cornelius, Lemke's opponent and leader of the Freedom Party, was slated to stop by in another week. Cedric sat at a picnic table in the center of the communal area, enjoying a late supper of mashed potatoes, corn, bread, and water from the neighboring river their community was named for. 2 trucks were parked across the street, their beds nearly overfilling with harvested corn from the surrounding fields. The food within their walls was more than enough to support the 300 people that lived in the compound. Most of the grain, corn, and beans they produced were shipped by rail to the nearly 100 other outposts in the Allied States. He thought of the mass migration from the western states to places like Turkey River over 8 years ago, when the government focused on consolidating, protecting, and rebuilding the agricultural industry in the Midwest and manufacturing factories on the East Coast. Now most of the population lived in places like Turkey River. Families of those who had made that migration ate quietly at the other tables around him. He sat alone and enjoyed his meal. He didn't mind the solitude, but it wasn't always that way. In his former life, he had once looked forward to meals with his wife and sons. But they were gone now, and he was here. Besides, most of the kids were scared of him, whispering behind his back about the pirate with a patch over his eye. He didn't mind that either. He was a kid once, and remembered how his own boys would have reacted. They might have thought he was a monster with his scarred skin and missing eye. But the truth was they had died knowing there were far worse monsters than a deformed old man. Most of the kids under 8 at Outpost Turkey River were lucky to have never seen the creatures Cedric fought. They no doubt heard the gunshots and the lone cries of a dying variant. But they had never come face to face with one of the scab-covered, fanged creatures. Not like his sons. Cedric pushed aside the painful memories. His job was no longer to be a father and a husband. He was just a simple soldier protecting the people that lived here, and the food they harvested. At least it gave him purpose. A bell dinged as the moon rose higher in the autumn sky. Cedric wolfed down the rest of his supper. He took a flask from his ballistic vest and washed the food down with a shot of whiskey. The liquor warmed his gut. He stood, well-fed and relaxed. Grabbing his M4A1 carbine, he set off for a patrol with the other half-dozen men on night perimeter duty. The team was just one cog helping spin the security wheel at the outpost. Two soldiers manned the M240 fighting position outside Town Hall. Guards walked on flat rooftops, their weapons cradled, looking out over the sleeping outpost. Everywhere Cedric looked, the soldiers seemed relaxed. There wasn't much to be stressed about out here. Most of the men hadn't seen action for years, besides skirmishes with raiders. Hell, this was the best gig of Cedric's career, and he'd had a ton of assignments since the hemorrhage virus first raced across the world, from a cruise ship sailing in the Atlantic during the first year of the outbreak to security duty in the relocated White House at the Greenbrier. Cedric had even guarded Captain Reed Beckham, his wife Dr. Kate Lovato Beckham, and their son Javier Riley, back when the boy was just a toddler. After Cedric hit retirement age, they transferred him here. Turkey River is a modern-day retirement community, my friend, Beckham had said, patting Cedric on the shoulder with his prosthetic hand. Plenty of food, good neighbors, and peaceful enough you can actually enjoy a well-earned nap in the afternoon. President Ringgold had even thanked Cedric for his service, and the next week he boarded a train to northern Iowa. Field of Dreams didn't seem so far from the truth. Cedric considered pulling his flask out and taking another slug of whiskey, but he was old enough and smart enough to know evil never slept. The variants might not have attacked recently, but beyond the wall, guard towers, razor wire fences, sensors, and minefields, they were still out there, waiting. He continued the trek through Town Square and past the houses and businesses. Like most outposts, this one had everything from a general store to a post office with solar panels mounted on most of the roofs. He walked by both buildings and moved to the sidewalk to let a pickup truck down the narrow road. The circular community was surrounded by a 20-foot steel wall. He exited through a gate that opened to a bridge over a creek. On the other side, six soldiers waited. Two German shepherds sat on their hind legs, anxious for their noses to be put to work. "Evening, Sarge," said a private named Malcolm. "Evening," Cedric replied. They set off. All of them knew the drill. Alpha Team went to the right and Bravo went left, each team taking a dog. Cedric was an exception. Commander Bell had given him his own route to walk, operating as a lone ranger of sorts. He walked toward the next line of defense, multiple razor wire fences. On the other side, moonlight captured a sea of corn and soybeans planted in the rich topsoil beyond the minefields. The gate at the road was closed now that the harvesting for the day was over. No one was allowed outside after dark unless Commander Bell gave the order. Guard towers rose above the fences, and Cedric raised a hand to the men in Tower 4. Both of the soldiers were about the same age he had been when he first enlisted over 40 years ago. But these kids were too young to have fought in the war against the monsters. Chances were good neither of them had ever come close to meeting a variant face to face. Cedric, on the other hand, had scars to show off his battles, including his empty eye socket. He smiled when he recalled how he had killed the beast that had done it. Who would have thought a flare would do so much damage if you stuck it in the right place?
"Got anything on infrared?" Cedric called up to the guards.
"Negative, Sarge. Just deer."
"Well, shit, maybe we should go hunting," Cedric replied.
It had been a long time since they had even seen a deer. Like humans, the animals had almost been wiped out by the variants. He continued his walk along the perimeter, scanning the dirt on the other side of the fences for any flash of movement and sniffing the air for the rotten fruit odor of the beasts. The variants had rapid evolution and adaptation on their side. Epigenetic changes had turned the abominations into the perfect predators that could camouflage their skin and see in the dark. Some had morphed into terrifying creatures ranging from gigantic beetles to monstrous flesh-eating worms in Europe. Most of those beasts were nothing more than dust now. Only the first generation of variants had survived the bullets and the bioweapons the government designed to kill them.
America was on her way back. Some European countries were starting to recover as well. He didn't know much about South America, Africa, or Asia, but the little bit of news that made their way to Turkey River gave him hope the human species would recover fully in time. Cedric walked for an hour before his joints started hurting, and the chill of the evening finally got under his layers. He let his rifle sag on its sling as he rubbed his gloves together. Then he pressed on, ignoring the pain of his lower back and the persistent arthritis in his fingers. He didn't mind that his retirement was being spent doing what he did best, but he did wonder how many more years he had left before Commander Bell assigned him to some boring guard tower.
Not happening anytime soon.
As the whiskey wore off, the cold crept into his feet. His toes started to numb. He found a seat on a swing hanging from the solid limb of an oak tree, a favorite of the children that lived here. He sat and wiggled his toes to get the blood moving. Pulling out his radio, he contacted Alpha and Bravo teams. No contacts sighted by any of them. He asked for reports from the guard towers next. All clear, came the responses. Another quiet night at Outpost Turkey River. Cedric stood and walked toward his next stop. The barns were always his favorite part of the rounds. A farmer named Will slept in a chair outside the barn, his head slumped against a shoulder. Cedric cleared his throat, waking the man. Will shot up and raised a hand in defense.
What's wrong?
Relax, Cedric said. I'm just checking on things. Will looked around, and then seemed to relax and sat back down. Does your wife know you're out here? Cedric asked. A sly grin spread across Will's face.
She's the reason I'm out here.
Cedric chuckled.
You're in the doghouse again? Better than the barn, right?
Will stood and stretched. Cedric held back a laugh. In a town this small, everyone knew everyone's business, and everyone knew that Will and his wife had been on the outs for months. Commotion from the animal pens distracted Cedric, and Will joined him on the path to the livestock. The beasts were all crowded in the corner of their pens. Will spat a glob of tobacco on the dirt.
What the hell has them riled up? He asked.
Cedric pulled out his radio.
Alpha, Bravo, you got anything?
Negative.
Negative.
The guard towers all reported the same thing. Nothing on infrared, and nothing moving in the night vision. Cedric knew the variants could sometimes avoid detection, but they couldn't avoid the mines or the fences, and they couldn't dodge bullets either. Cedric aimed his rifle at the cornfields beyond the animal pens and jerked his chin for Will to return to the safety of the walled-off compound.
Go home to your wife and lock the doors, he said.
Will backpedaled away from the barn, nearly tripping. Then he turned and ran. Most men would have done the same thing, but Cedric clenched his jaw and scanned the fields for the monsters. Moonlight illuminated the white blades of two massive wind turbines churning in the distance, providing energy for the outpost by harnessing the wind. His radio crackled on his vest as he searched for hostiles.
Master Sergeant, what's going on out there? Came the gruff voice of Commander Bell.
Not sure, sir. Something's got the animal spooked.
Meet me on the bridge, Bell replied.
Cedric cursed.
So much for a quiet night.
He jogged back toward the bridge, the gate opening and disgorging 10 more men and 3 dogs. From the east side of the outpost came the guttural barking of the other German shepherds with Alpha and Bravo. A flare shot up into the sky, bursting into a red glow over the cornfields.
Everyone that's not in a guard tower, fall back to the bridge, Bell ordered over the radio.
Searchlights flipped on in the towers, the beams raking over the cornfields beneath where the flare had burst. The stalks rustled in the breeze. Bell, a good foot taller than almost every man on the bridge, stepped out in front of the pack. All 5 of the dogs growled, their fur standing like needles. Cedric straightened his stiff body.
Everyone that's not in a guard tower, fall back to the bridge, Bell ordered over the radio. Show yourself, you diseased son of a bitch. Bell grumbled.
The spotlight from Tower 4 roved over the field, Cedric's only eye moving with the light. The guard brought it to a sudden stop over a patch of corn. Alpha and Bravo soon returned with their dogs.
Commander, I've got a heat signature northwest, close to the area I spotted a deer earlier, came the voice of Isaac in Tower 4.
Not sure what it is.
Can you get a shot?
Bell replied.
Sir, it's pretty far out.
Bell turned back to the men on the bridge.
Get ready. I want a team to go out there with dogs and take a look once it's dead, he said. If it's a variant, leave it there. We'll try and find where it came from in the morning.
And if it's a deer? Cedric asked.
Then we're going to have a nice venison steak, Bell said.
The other men seemed to lighten up at that.
Take the shot, T4, Bell said over the comm.
Crows took flight around the compound. For an eerie moment, the cawing was the only sound.
Target down, Isaac reported over the radio.
Nice shot, T4, Bell replied.
He looked again at the soldiers standing around him.
Who's going out there to check it out?
Cedric's hand shot up.
I'll go, sir.
Who else?
Bell asked. The men all avoided his gaze, looking at the ground in shame. Cedric didn't blame them. Even one variant was enough to kill a team of greenhorns, and they were likely worried there were more beasts out there.
Malcolm, Agin, Kelly, you go with Cedric. Take two dogs. The rest of you fall back inside the compound, Bell said.
Cedric led the other three soldiers over the bridge, the dogs pulling on their leashes down the road to the main gate. They stopped when they reached the guard tower that looked over the minefield beyond the gate.
You sure you got it? Cedric called up.
Isaac emerged from the tower.
It ain't moving, Sarge.
Cedric looked down the road, cutting through the cornfields. A shudder tore through his flesh. He blamed it on the cold, but worried it was from fear.
Go on, Cedric, Bell said. Take your team out there and see what's going on.
Yes, sir, Cedric said.
They unlatched the main gate and swung it open. Cedric led the team outside, listening to the gate click shut behind him.
T4, tell me if that heat signature moves, he ordered over the comm.
Copy that, Isaac replied.
Combat intervals. Keep sharp, Cedric said.
He started out onto the road with the dogs on each flank. They sniffed the ground and air, their muzzles searching for the rotting lemon scent of the deceased beasts. Cedric scanned for movement, but saw nothing besides the shifting corn stalks. It only took a few minutes to reach the area of the spotlight from Tower 4. The team stopped and faced the fence of corn. None of the dogs bared their teeth or growled.
Maybe it was just a deer, Cedric thought.
He shouldered his rifle, and the other three soldiers followed suit, their muzzles aimed at the corn.
I'm not going in there, Malcolm whispered.
Cedric thought about ordering the young soldier to get a hold of himself and go in anyway. But instead, he said,
Hold your position.
He didn't need a scared kid popping off rounds behind him in the dark. The gusting wind picked up as they stood there, blowing through the fields violently and turning the wind turbines faster. The branches of oak trees in the distance swayed and creaked.
Do you see that?
Kelly said quietly. He pointed at the tips of the corn that seemed to be parting, like something was moving through them.
T4, you got anything on infrared? Cedric asked.
Negative. Something's coming, Kelly said.
Cedric held up a hand.
Hold your fire.
The wind calmed, and the corn stalks straightened.
I'm going in, Cedric said.
Agin, you got the balls to follow?
The big man nodded and followed Cedric into the field, using the spotlight to guide them. Stalks scraped against their skin, scratching his neck and face. Through the gaps in the corn, Cedric spotted something lying in a fetal position under the glow from the light. He aimed his muzzle at it and moved his finger to the trigger. A sudden screech in the distance made him flinch.
There's another one out there, Agin whispered.
Cedric moved over to the creature lying in the dirt. Something twisted in his gut. It wasn't a creature at all. It was a filthy human. Blood soiled the dirt, but the guy seemed to still be alive, his ribs expanding and contracting slowly. Agin lowered his rifle. Cedric went to radio it in. Another high-pitched wail pierced the night. The call of a monster.
Help me with him, Cedric said.
Together, the two soldiers carried the injured man back to the road where Malcolm and Kelly stood with the dogs. The animals cowered, their tails between their legs.
Keep it together, Cedric ordered. There is one of those things and four of us. You run, you die.
Fuck it. I'll take my chances, Kelly said.
He let go of the dog leash and took off. The radio crackled with confused voices. Cedric ignored them as they carefully put the injured man down.
"He's hurt bad," Agin said.
Another screech came, this time from the opposite direction. Malcolm abandoned them then, running after Kelly. The two remaining dogs both growled and barked viciously. Gunshots popped through the night as the radio exploded with panicked voices.
"Agin, watch our back," Cedric said. "Okay, Sarge."
Cedric bent down and rolled the man over gently. Blood covered his side. The bullet had hit him just under his ribs. The man was young, maybe in his 30s, hard to say, with mud caking most of his features. Cedric knew they couldn't carry him back, but he wasn't going to leave him here. They needed to get him up and moving. Using a gloved hand, Cedric slapped the guy on the cheek, trying to rouse him to consciousness. The man winced in pain, breathing heavily.
"You need to get up," Cedric said.
He clamped a hand over the wound and looked up at Agin.
"You cover us on the way back to the gate," he said.
Agin nodded quickly. Cedric went to help the guy up, but the man grabbed his wrist, squeezing hard. His eyes widened like he was caught in the grips of insanity.
"It's too late," he mumbled. "You can't go back there."
More gunshots cracked out, and a second variant screech sounded. Then came the screams. Cedric glanced over his shoulder at the gate where Malcolm and Kelly were still waiting to get back in. A landmine exploded in the distance, the boom thumping like a grenade. When Cedric looked back to the two soldiers at the gate, they were gone, shadows sweeping them into the field. A human cry of agony rose like the howling wind. Agin backpedaled.
"Sarge," he whispered.
Two variants skittered up the side of Tower 4. They reached in from opposite sides, surprising Isaac and the other guard. The beasts yanked them out and tossed them onto the cornfield on the other side of the fence. Another boom thumped as the two men were blown to pieces. The beasts climbed higher up the tower before perching on the top. Wispy hair blew away the pale skin of the creature on the left, a female, judging from her naked chest. The male one reared his head back and let out a howl. Several more abominations answered the call.
"We have to go," mumbled the wounded man.
Cedric yanked free of his grip and stood. Dozens of the monsters climbed to the top of rooftops inside the compound.
"How?" he said.
"How did they get inside?"
"I came from out there. To warn."
The injured man pointed in the opposite direction of the outpost.
"I came to warn you," whimpered the man.
Cedric hesitated, trying to make sense of things. The guy had to be one of the homesteaders trying to strike out independent from the outposts.
"Sarge, what do we do?"
Agin's voice was breaking from fear. The two shepherds took off running away from the compound, racing as fast as they could into the cornfields. Screams of horror filled the night. Cedric imagined the monsters tearing through the outpost, devouring the people inside.
"Sarge," Agin entreated.
"What do we do?"
For the first time in his career, Cedric did what he always damned other men for doing. He turned, and he ran away from the fight, following the dogs into the darkness.
2.
At dawn, Kate Lovato walked along the Peaks Island shoreline of Casco Bay, Maine. It was the same thing she did most mornings. The humble house she shared with her husband, Reed Beckham, and 8-year-old son, was just 500 feet from the water's edge, close enough Beckham didn't mind her morning excursions. When she first started the habit of coming to the water, he wasn't thrilled about it. Their lives before Peaks Island had been fraught with threats, and Beckham had never let his guard down over the years. But they trusted one another, and it would take a miracle for a variant to get through the secure barriers. Peaks Island was in the heart of a safe zone, surrounded by advanced sensors, soldiers, sailors, and friends. If anything were to happen, a hidden underground safe house at the community health center that doubled as her lab provided a final line of defense. She took a seat on a bench to soak in the clementine sunrise simmering on the horizon. Taking a sip from her steaming mug, she reveled in the small pleasure. The past 8 years had been extremely difficult. But despite the odds, they had started to recover and bring back staples like coffee that was grown in Florida. It wasn't as good as the beans from South America and Africa she had enjoyed before the war, but it was better than nothing. Still, living on an island was a constant reminder of Plum Island. The secret government labs were ground zero for the bioweapon she had helped design. In the end, the weapon hadn't just killed billions of infected humans. It had created the variants. You did what you had to do, Kate. To save us. To save humanity from the brink of extinction, President Jan Ringgold had reminded her over 7 years ago. Guilt at what her research had brought about consumed Kate to this day. Most countries were clawing themselves out of complete anarchy after the end of the war. Even in the Allied States, people were still fleeing poverty, starvation, and violence. Park Island and Outpost Portland continued to receive refugees on an almost daily basis.
Morning, came a voice.
She pivoted and smiled when she saw Beckham making his way over. He wore a gray army sweatshirt and camouflage pants. Reaching up with his prosthetic hand, he brushed his thick long hair behind an ear and took a seat next to her. The hand was a reminder of what Beckham had lost over 8 years ago from a variant acid attack, as well as a portion of his leg. But even though his leg and hand might be artificial, the man behind those prosthetics was every bit as strong as he'd been back then. Probably even stronger now. Coffee? She asked, offering her drink to him.
Sure.
He took a sip and directed his gaze at the water. He was legally blind in his right eye, but he had experienced some improvement thanks to the steroids and pharmaceutical cocktails she had cooked up in her lab on the island.
You're up early, she said.
Got a lot on my mind.
The meeting with President Ringgold?
Kate scooted close to him, feeling his warmth.
Did she tell you why she wants to meet?
Nope. But my gut tells me it's political. No matter how many times I tell her that I am not cut out for that life, she encourages me to reconsider.
Beckham took another drink.
I think she wants me to challenge Senator McComb.
Kate narrowed her brows.
But McComb is a Ringgold supporter, isn't he?
Apparently not as much as she would like. Or maybe he's not supportive of Vice President Lemke's bid for the presidency.
I'm surprised they haven't tapped you to be Lemke's running mate, Kate said, only half-joking.
The process had changed, and the vice president wouldn't be selected until after the election now. He didn't respond, clearly in deep thought. Kate put a hand on his arm.
You have done enough for your country, Reed. No need to start a second career in politics, she said.
Selfishly, that's what Kate believed, but her husband was a special man, and she knew there might come a time when he was needed off the island.
What else is bothering you? She asked, sensing that wasn't the only thing.
Things have been quiet on the frontier.
Too quiet.
Quiet is good. It means the variants are dying. We can live in peace and focus on rebuilding.
Quiet scares me, Beckham replied.
In war, it usually means the enemy is planning something. But I'm not just worried about variants. With elections looming, I'm worried about what happens after President Ringgold leaves office.
He took another drink and paused to reflect.
Her legacy and our country is at risk if the Freedom Party takes over.
They won't, Kate said confidently.
Beckham handed her the coffee mug back and stood, his prosthetic leg creaking.
I wouldn't be too optimistic. The most recent polls show General Cornelius leading Vice President Lemke by almost 4 points.
Polls always leave room for error, Kate said,
and that lead is well within the margin of error.
Well, there are other signs that things aren't looking good for the New America Coalition.
I know, she admitted. Vice President Lemke has almost as many enemies as President Ringgold does. Maybe even more.
It wasn't surprising to Kate, considering the former admiral of the naval fleet had helped take back the country from Resistance of Tyranny, ROT, 8 years ago.
The biggest issue seems to be over the cities in the frontier, Beckham said. The Freedom Party is proposing the conscription of all men and women between the age of 18 and 30. More and more people think we should try and take the cities back instead of letting the variants have what once was ours.
Kate hated the thought of sending more young men and women into the meat grinder. Those that were coming of age had been just kids during the war. Parker Horn's daughters, Tasha and Jenny, would almost be of age to serve,
Police officer Jake Temper's son Timothy and Donna Tufo's son Bo would be able to join the military. She shuddered at the thought of any of them being sent to the front lines. For a moment she fell into silence with Beckham, considering the implications of the election just 3 months away. The areas outside the safe zones had been abandoned after the Great War, left for nature to reclaim as the variants died off. Some human survivors lived in the lawless zones, preferring life on their own rather than in the outposts and cities. If the Freedom Party had their way, those people would be forced out of the frontier. The cities would be bombed into oblivion, and the young would be sent to fight and die, like they had in every other war. But the human race was still teetering on the edge, and the post-war generation that included Tasha, Jenny, Bo, and Timothy couldn't afford to be wasted. That's why President Ringgold had taken a more measured approach by sending in Team Ghost and other teams to take out any variants that threatened outposts. Fitz was out there now, Kate thought, doing what he did best, hunting down variants. Beckham broke the quiet between them. The Freedom Party is gaining support, especially with voters in the outposts that have been attacked by variants, he said. People are scared. They should be scared of Cornelius and the Freedom Party. It's basically ROT in disguise, in my opinion. I guess people are forgetting ROT nearly destroyed us. I wouldn't exactly compare them with ROT, but I know what you're saying. Some things never change, huh? Beckham chuckled. I think politics will outlive the human race. People will still be fighting in their graves. Can't do anything about that. He brushed his hair back again. No, but there is something we can do about that hair, she grinned. I kind of like it, to be honest. Kate kissed him on the cheek. Whatever you want, my love, but I agree. No politics for now, okay? No politics ever if I have it my way. They watched the sunrise for a few more minutes before heading back to their house. Jake, the former New York police officer, shut the door to his house and said goodbye to his son, Timothy. Morning, Jake, Beckham called out. Morning, Jake yelled back. He started off for his guard tower post near the ferry. The vessel was waiting to take early morning workers to the town of Portland, just 3 miles away. Kate liked the fact she rarely had to leave the island. She taught school here and ran her small lab. The only times she had to go to the mainland were for groceries or meetings at town hall. Life was good. The best it had been in a long time. But there were painful reminders of the old world everywhere. Beckham stopped at a tree that provided a canopy of green over their yard. He took a knee at the grave of his best four-legged friend. I miss him, Beckham said. Kate put a hand on his back. Apollo lived a good long life. Beckham nodded. He was a loyal dog. The best. Yes, he was. Reaching up, Beckham wiped a tear from his eye. They had just lost Apollo to old age a few months back. They weren't sure how old he was when he crossed the Rainbow Bridge, but he had passed peacefully, surrounded by friends and family. Now he was buried next to the one female dog he had loved, a free-spirited mutt he had met when they first moved here. Kate put an arm around Beckham, and they walked around the house to the front yard. A voice called out across the road. Parker Horn, dressed in nothing but sweatpants, lifted a tattooed arm to wave from his open front door. It was rare seeing him up this early, but Kate saw what had brought him outside. The big man smoked a homemade cigarette as Apollo's daughter and son ran out of Horn's house barking. Ginger and Spark darted across the road and over to Beckham and Kate. The 4-year-old German Shepherd mixes belonged to Horn's girls Tasha and Jenny. Beckham grinned as he knelt to play with the dogs. It was good to see him so happy. She wanted to feel that way too, but her gut wouldn't let her. Something was changing on the frontier, and it wasn't just the shadowy variant forces. With President Ringgold's second term just months away from ending, the country faced the uncertainty of a new leader. The human race had avoided near extinction once, but this time, she wasn't sure they could dodge another bullet if the voters decided to elect Cornelius and support his march back to war. Master Sergeant Joe Fitz Fitzpatrick stood at the top of a hill overlooking Ellicott City. Elms and dogwoods blazed with the colors of late autumn. His carbon fiber blades creaked ever so slightly as he adjusted his weight to pivot for a better view. It was hard for him to believe he'd lost his flesh and blood legs so long ago in Iraq, long before the variants were even a nightmare on this planet. But now his prosthetics were as natural to him as his muscles and nerves had once been. Maybe even better. At least good enough to propel him toward their enemies. Somewhere out there, an Alpha variant hid in the shadows with its kin. Team Ghost had the mission to hunt it down and locate the three humans the beasts had kidnapped from Outpost Patasco Valley just over 20 miles away. Chances were good all three were already dead, but Team Ghost wouldn't give up until they found them. For the past 8 years, they had run missions into the frontier and lawless zones to do exactly that, find and kill variants and rescue any humans that were snatched by the beasts. A loose wooden plank on the church next to him rattled. Chips of white paint fluttered away like dust in a gust of wind that rustled his uniform.
"Apollo would have loved a day like this," Fitz said.
The dog had retired several years ago to live out its final days with Beckham and Kate. Fitz had considered asking for Ginger or Spark to be added to the team, but their fate was as pets, not warriors, and the girls had fallen in love with them anyways. Footsteps crunched over the gravel, and Sergeant First Class Jenny Rico joined Fitz at the lookout. She smiled as she chomped on stale gum. Strands of pink hair under the rim of her helmet rustled in the wind. She always found a way to figuratively and literally make things more colorful. They had fought together and remained lovers for the past 8 years. Through all of the battles, heartbreak, and loss, they had found a balance of sorts in their relationship. But Fitz still worried about losing her every time they came out here. He knew loss well. It haunted him. His brothers had been taken from him by friendly fire in a war long before the variants. His parents were lost in a tragic car accident. Over the years, he had lost more brothers and sisters in the war against the variants than he cared to count. A painful stabbing coursed through his gut any time he thought of Rico falling in battle. Fitz had been close to the edge many times in his life, especially around the time Beckham found him at Fort Bragg. The man had saved his life by giving him a gun and a purpose. Rico had given him even more. By her side, he actually had optimism. Optimism that there was something worth fighting for. She had taught him how to strive for a better future for the rest of the world, and for each other. Their time together also meant she could read him like an open book.
"What's wrong, Fitzy?" she said.
"Just thinking of Apollo."
Rico looked toward the lake, and then chuckled.
"Remember him shaking that dirty-ass water all over us after he jumped into a swamp on his last mission?"
"Oh, yeah," Fitz said.
"At least he's at rest where Beckham and Kate are."
"At least he's at rest where Beckham and Kate are," Sergeant Yazdohai said in his stoic tone.
The Navajo man stroked his gray goatee that was far longer than regulation length.
"He sure earned his long rest. And I'm glad he enjoyed his golden years in a place free of monsters," Rico said.
Fitz nodded in agreement.
"Yeah, me too. He was a good boy."
The dog had hunted more than his fair share of monsters, but there were plenty of beasts that still dwelled in places like this, apocalyptic landscapes that posed dangers with every step. Telephone poles leaned sideways and lines hung between the poles, draped over the muddy brown water flowing through the street. Brick buildings sported dark windows with shards of glass like the jagged teeth of variants. Fitz remembered this city as having a scenic downtown, a perfect place for day trippers to explore the antique and boutique stores before stopping for a beer and sandwich at the brewery.
"Would have been a good place to take Rico on a date night," he thought.
"So this is Ellicott City, huh?"
Specialist Justin Mendez said, moving to stand beside Fitz. Mendez's thick black eyebrows arched like caterpillars. He paused.
"Holy shit," he said, raising a scope to his eyes.
Fitz signaled for Team Ghost to hunch down.
"You got a hostile?" Fitz asked.
Mendez lowered the rifle.
"No, man. It's a 69 Mustang GT, he mumbled. "Damn shame to see a car like that all rusted."
"Jesus, you scared me, man," said Rico, rising back to her feet.
"I had a car like that,"
Corporal Bobby A. said.
"Well, seriously?"
Mendez asked. Ace nodded. More like a 67 Camaro, but basically the same thing.
Same thing my ass, old man.
Mendez shook his head while staring at Ace. Ace laughed a deep sound that welled up from his large belly. A scraggly white beard hung from his chin, shaped like the machete he kept on his belt. Wrinkles formed canyons around his leathery skin. Sometimes Fitz was shocked the guy could keep up with the rest of the team. His age and weight would have kept him from even being considered for Delta Force back in the day, but men with his fighting experience were a rare breed nowadays. Team Ghost was lucky to have him. Ace was an artist with his custom mag-fed Mossberg 500 shotgun and had the killer instinct Fitz was looking for. He selected the corporal to replace men he had lost in an ambush by an Alpha. Men like Staff Sergeant Blake Tanaka and Sergeant Hugh Stevenson. Fitz shook off the memory and focused on the final member of Team Ghost. Specialist Will Lincoln held an M4A1 across his chest. He directed eyes as dark as skin at Fitz. The thin young man had joined the team the same time as Ace. What his frame lacked in muscle, he made up for in a mind quick and sharp as a variant's claws. He also provided comedic relief and music in dark times.
You girls in your cars, he grumbled.
Girls? Mendez asked, raising one of his brows.
Just messing, brother, Lincoln said.
So, y'all ready to get this hunt started, or what?
Take in some water. We move out soon, Fitz said. He looked out over the city again, glad they had been sent here instead of Baltimore. Compared to the bigger city, Ellicott City was in decent condition, even with the flooding. America's urban centers were largely decaying wastelands, destroyed by the effort to push the variants out of the country, especially on the West Coast. Most of their missions were to places in the Midwest and East Coast, now that the western part of the country had almost completely been destroyed and abandoned. Humanity abandoned many of the major cities and left them to the abominations that haunted them, still thirsting for fresh protein. Rumor had reached Team Ghost that the Freedom Party wanted to destroy even more of what remained, including places like this, where the variants still posed a threat. Fitz was a soldier, but he also had an opinion, and had given it to Beckham the last time they talked. Much like national parks had once been, places like this needed to be protected. He took in a breath before giving the order.
All it takes is all you got, he thought.
Dohai, you take point. Ace, you got rear guard, Fitz said. Stay sharp, Ghost.
It was the usual setup, since Dohai was the best tracker on the team, and Ace had never let anyone or anything sneak up on them. The team moved out, all business now that they had passed into variant territory. With the sun still high in the sky, they kept low and close to cover, their weapons shouldered and roving for targets. Dohai moved slowly. Ears perked and eyes moving as he stepped through the ankle-high water. Fitz kept behind him, scanning the interior of the stores and checking every window for any sign of hostiles. Deep within the next store, he saw pangs of sunlight reflect off the costume jewelry around the neck of a mannequin.
Jesus, Rico said. Thought that was a person at first.
Nope. But that was, Lincoln said.
He raised his rifle, aiming at the spot that had caught his interest across the road. The bottom half of a human skeleton hung out of a window, mold climbing up from the flooded street as if reaching toward it. Fitz motioned for the team to check it out. When they got to the second floor window, he stepped underneath to see that the flesh was completely gone. Tooth marks marred the dried bone. Some were snapped like twigs, the marrow sucked dry.
Guess we know we're in the right place, Rico said dryly.
Fitz looked one last time at the skeletal remains. This was the worst part of tracking down rogue variants. Team Ghost almost always arrived too late to help. But they would find the abominations responsible. According to the reports they'd received, this one was a wily alpha. Smarter than the average grunt beast, judging by how he'd been sneaking in and out of outpost Potasco Valley without any of the guards getting a clear shot at it. Fitz flashed hand signals, and the team continued between the brick buildings. A flurry of leaves rustled over the street. Flashes of orange and brown landed in the water, floating away with the slight current at their feet. The crisp scent of autumn, mixed with the odor of must and mold, drifted from the buildings. but he didn't detect the sour odor of a variant.
We got another skinny, Mendez said.
With his rifle, he pointed to a second corpse propped up against a bench next to a toppled garbage can. Flags of ripe flesh hung off the bones.
Looks fresh, Dohai said.
That sent another stab of dread through Fitz's gut. Apparently, the Alpha had been hunting in other areas, too. The sooner they killed it, the safer this area would be. The team continued to survey the street. They were coming to the end of the small, historic downtown. A railway bridge crossed 20 feet above the street. On it was painted Ellicott City in white, blocky letters. A freight train had derailed off the bridge and fallen to the street. The toppled cars served as a dam. Water rushed up against it and trickled between the graffiti-covered cars. Broken crates and steel drums were piled around the train. Graffiti wasn't the only thing covering them. Dark stains that could only be blood marked the sides like a macabre painting.
We've got to be close, Fitz said. Stay sharp.
They moved out in combat intervals and squeezed between the train cars. As Fitz came out the other side, water rushed around his blades and streamed toward the river beyond. Before them lay another bridge, this one for cars.
Do you hear that? Dohai asked.
Fitz held up a fist to signal the rest of the team to hold tight. He strained his ears, listening for what Dohai had noticed. Between the gusts of wind, he picked up a quiet chorus of something clinking together. The sound reminded him of wind chimes, only instead of metal, they sounded almost like wood.
What the hell is that?
Rico whispered. The team advanced across the bridge and skirted around the abandoned cars there. The wind chime chorus grew louder. Fitz tilted his head to listen. It seemed to be originating below them. He leaned over the handrail and peered down at a stomach-rolling sight. Bones strung up beneath the bridge rattled in the wind. Tendrils of red hung from the broken edges, and droplets of red trickled off them. He didn't need Dohai to tell him these were also fresh kills. Team Ghost had found two of the human prisoners. Fitz balled his hand and froze at a scream of sheer agony in the distance. It started off almost animalistic, but by the tail end of the wail, he could tell it was human. There was still someone alive out there. At least for now. Dohai pointed toward a forested area off the road, and Fitz gave the order to pursue the Alpha with a nod. Team Ghost wasn't going home until it had put down this beast.
3.
President Jan Ringgold took a long drink of cold coffee. She was going to need it tonight. Across from her sat Vice President Dan Lemke. Both of them had been waiting anxiously for her chief of staff, James Soprano, to arrive at her presidential office in the Greenbrier. The knock came a few minutes later, and the door opened.
Evening, Soprano said, wandering over to her desk, carrying a stack of briefing folders.
I hope you've got good news for me, Ringgold said.
I haven't looked yet, Madam President. Soprano gently set the stack of folders on her desk and then backed away.
Thank you, she said to her COS. We'll catch up shortly.
Soprano exited the room with a nod toward Ringgold and Lemke. Ringgold began shuffling through the folders. Most contained information about her meetings tomorrow, but she went right for the one with the recent poll numbers for the upcoming election.
The moment of truth, Ringgold said.
She took in a breath and opened the folder.
There we are.
Well?
Asked Lemke.
Ringgold smiled.
The numbers were good, better than she had thought. Almost 7 points in her party's favor and well outside the margin of error.
We might just win this thing after all, she said. Our recent campaign efforts seem to have pushed things further in our favor.
Vice President Dan Lemke leaned forward in his chair. She spun the folder around so he could read them.
That's because people have a lot to be happy about, Madam President, he said. You brought us back from the brink over these 8 years. We've come a long way from hiding in bunkers and praying during every attack that we would survive for another day.
She leaned back slightly in her chair, looking out the bulletproof window at the trees. The branches swayed in the wind outside, and moonlight cast a white glow on the bark that made them look like skeletal fingers. A cold wave snaked through her body.
Tonight is not the night to be spooked, Ringgold thought.
Ringgold gave herself a moment to relish in some of her accomplishments in the face of this good news. The migration from the West Coast and Mountain States during her first term had been risky, but it had paid off. She had been better able to protect their citizens over the consolidated territory and focus on rebuilding important infrastructure to keep them alive. The economy was rolling along, and recently it was accelerating. Dormant industries had reawakened. Factories were producing vehicles for both military and civilian use. An old GM plant had already put out 3,000 new cars, a fraction of what it had once been. But it was a start. Farms and orchards across the Allied states were producing enough food again to feed all the country's citizens. Wind turbines and solar energy helped power the farms. The government had even rebuilt part of the electrical grid. Telecommunications engineers were getting close to restoring a cellular network that would support personal cell phone use. In Texas, several oil operations were back up and running to fuel the expanding economy. The country was using all the resources at its disposal to come back online. But there were some things she wasn't sure she wanted to return. Social media, for starters. She kind of liked the quiet. For one, it made presidential campaigns a lot more straightforward. The biggest indicator the country was recovering were the relatively infrequent variant attacks. The beasts were still out there, sure. Some even speculated they were breeding underground. But at least their numbers were manageable, and the damage they did cause was minor, despite it still being a loss of human life. Lemke stood and tightened his navy tie. The retired Rear Admiral had helped save the country from ROT. His transition to politics had been surprisingly easy for him after his long tenure of military service. He was Kennedy family handsome, with thick wavy hair, dimples, and a perfect smile. His charming East Coast accent put even fierce political enemies at ease. He knew when to flash a grin and when to keep a straight face. Best of all, he was loyal and intelligent. The perfect person to keep the country moving forward.
You're going to make a hell of a president, Ringgold said. And I'm going to enjoy watching you from retirement with a mojito in hand.
I hope you'll be willing to answer my calls, even when you're sipping that drink, Lemke said.
If I'm going to be a good president, it's only because I have you to thank.
Ringgold almost blushed.
I can't think of any president besides Abe Lincoln that had to deal with such a traumatic war in our homeland the way you have, Lemke added. And somehow we still came out of all that with hope for a better future.
Oh, I see you're already preparing your next talking points for the campaign trail, Ringgold said with a chuckle.
The dimples on his face widened slightly until he looked down at his buzzing government-issued cell phone. Any humor in his expression immediately evaporated.
What is it? She asked.
Trouble if I had to guess, he replied.
General Souza at SOCOM doesn't ever call just to shoot the bull.
Ringgold got out of her chair and moved around her desk, forgetting the poll numbers and the stacks of files for tomorrow's meetings. Lemke took the call in the center of the room, standing behind two couches positioned around a coffee table.
What?
He asked Souza, furrowing his brow. He flung a glance at Ringgold and then turned slightly, shaking his head.
This couldn't be good.
She walked over to the couches but couldn't bring herself to sit. She was too nervous to remain still.
Understood, Lemke said. Keep me updated.
He lowered the phone and slowly slipped it into his pocket, pausing like he was nervous to turn and face her.
Well, Ringgold asked. What is it?
Lemke shook his head. The normally collected Rear Admiral turned politician looked like he had seen a ghost.
Outpost Turkey River, he said in almost a whisper. They've gone completely dark. Madam President.
I'm bored as hell, brother, Horn muttered quietly.
He pulled on his jacket cuff.
And I hate wearing this dumb shit.
Me and you both, Beckham replied.
They stood inside the guest lobby of the White House dressed in suits that needed tailoring. Most of the people waiting in the room were business folk and politicians that had thrived during the Reconstruction period. Several of Ringgold's security detail stood watching the civilians in the lobby like hawks. Beckham was doing the same thing. It was hard to know who here was a friend and who was an enemy. A man with a real lip-hugger of a mustache stood with his back to a marble column. He wore a cowboy hat, leather boots, and a shiny belt buckle. His gun holster and the holsters on the two bodyguards that accompanied him were empty, their weapons taken by Secret Service.
"Get a load of Chuck Norris over there," Horn whispered. "Who the hell is he?"
Beckham chuckled.
"If I had to guess, that's S.M. Fisher, the oil guy."
He had heard the oil tycoon had survived in his doomsday bunker with a group of personal bodyguards during the war. Unlike Beckham and Horn, Fisher probably wasn't here to advise President Ringgold. From what Beckham had heard, Fisher would be here to interview the president and vice president. As one of the wealthiest men left in the country and with one of the biggest oil fields, Fisher's support would go a long way for whoever he decided to support in the presidential elections.
"Maybe I should encourage him to make the right choice," Beckham thought.
Before he could consider the idea thoroughly, a short Latina woman dressed in a business-length skirt, a blouse, and a suit jacket opened a door across the hall. Beckham recognized her right away. Elizabeth Cortez had started off as a staffer for President Ringgold and now served as chief of staff for Vice President Lemke.
"Mr. Fisher, the president and vice president are ready for you," Cortez said.
Fisher took off his cowboy hat as he followed her into an office. He looked at Beckham for a lingering second, perhaps sizing him up. Beckham's prosthetics and the stories that probably verged more on myth than truth meant he often got looks like that. Most everyone here knew his part in the war. He was also the husband of the woman that had saved the world, or destroyed it, depending on whom you ask.
"Always last on the list," Horn grumbled. "You know the drill. The wealthy and powerful always get seats at the table first." "Yeah, yeah," Horn said. "Some days I really do miss the battlefield over this boring shit. At least I had more of an impact and knew why I was there." "We'll find out soon enough, and then go straight home," Beckham promised.
He took in a deep breath. He missed the brotherhood that came with serving his country, but he didn't miss the death. Part of him was glad to be retired and raising a family. One by one, the other people in the lobby were led into the president and vice president's offices, while Beckham and Horn continued to wait. National Security Advisor Ben Nelson and Ringgold's Chief of Staff James Soprano opened their doors and met with more businessmen and other politicians from the Allied States. Retired General Cornelius would be doing the same thing at his home base, Outpost Galveston, in Texas. The Ocean community had become the hub for the Freedom Opposition Party. He had even organized his own mercenary army there with over 2,000 soldiers. They came from all over, a hodgepodge of armed military contractors, former U.S. service men and women, and militia soldiers from other outposts that had defected to Galveston. The troops had access to the best weapons, armored vehicles, and even aircraft, thanks to Cornelius's strategic alliances with former manufacturers and military contractors. Not only did Cornelius plan to grow these forces and take back the West Coast and abandoned cities by augmenting them with a conscripted army if he was elected, he intended to use low-yield nukes. His strategy